From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. We actually have a very special show for you here today. We are here with most of the KEI staff for our 2016 wrap-up 2017 prediction episode. We're going to be talking about a lot of important things that happened in 2016, and then also looking ahead at the next year, what might be happening in Korea and around Asia. I think it would be best if you guys just went around the table and introduced yourselves so that our listeners know who you all are.
Sure. I'm Don Manzullo, the president and CEO of Korea Economic Institute.
Troy Stangarone, the Senior Director for Congressional Affairs and Trade.
Kyle Ferrier, Director of Academic Affairs and Research.
Phil Eskelin, the Executive Director here at KEI.
Mark Tokola, Vice President.
And of course, I'm Jenna Gibson, the Director of Communications here at KEI, and your host here on Korean Context. So to get the conversation started, what I want to do is have everybody go around. We'll do kind of a lightning round. And keeping in mind that, of course, we had a huge election here in the United States, and that's going to have a lot of repercussions going forward into the next year. But besides that, what would you say was the most important event that's going to shape the year ahead for Korea?
Two things. First thing is the complete rejection of TPP. That's huge. Second thing is the Cubs winning the World Series.
Well, I would definitely agree with the Cubs winning the World Series. But on a more serious note, I think, you know, for me, the most significant event, and there have been a lot of significant things that have happened in 2016, is probably the impeachment of Park Geun-hye. This is something that, unlike, you know, a North Korean nuclear test or something, nobody saw coming. It potentially, depending on what the Constitutional Court finds, could lead to an early election in South Korea next year. So I think, you know, that's probably, for me, the most significant event of 2016.
I think it's hard not to talk about the two nuclear tests that took place in 2016 coming out of North Korea. 2016 is the first year where two nuclear tests took place, and in between them we also saw a number of missile launches in the SLBM test.
Building on that, I also think the sanctions that were adopted by the United Nations, the noose is tightening, and China is agreeing more and more to have tougher sanctions on North Korea. That's a big change from even several years ago, where China was usually backing up North Korea and not being very proactive in terms of getting tough on North Korea. But now we're seeing them acceding to international demands to get tougher on North Korea.
Sometimes it's hard to know what's important until later. It may be when you look back on 2016 in the future, we'll decide that the Korean People's Congress, the May Congress, that was the first in 1980 in North Korea, will be seen as an important event, because it may be marking a change in the way North Korea operates. There's a lot of changes going on in the North, outlined in Kim Jong-un's speech at that party Congress. It may have meant nothing, but it may be very important. We'll know later.
All right, so I do want to get to what I would maybe think of as the elephant in the room as far as the things we've been talking about for 2016, which, of course, was this surprising election of Donald Trump as the incoming president of the United States. So we have talked about this quite a bit, and, of course, this is something that's very important, but I want to know if you guys have any thoughts about the enduring impact of this election as a major event here in 2016.
Well, your use of the word elephant in the room is interesting. I'm not sure Donald Trump's actually a Republican. I think that he got elected by beating two parties. I think he beat the Republican establishment and then beat the Democrats. So he is a unique character.
Yeah, I would agree with Mark. I mean, what Mark said earlier even too about events perhaps having greater meaning later on than now. We went through a campaign where it's hard to know what Donald Trump really thinks in terms of foreign policy. He's gone from suggesting South Korea and Japan should have nuclear weapons to now saying that he never meant that. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty on what he means for the alliance going forward. But that being said, when we look at, you know, the prospects of the impact of a Trump administration, I think the one thing that we can be certain about is that whatever he is going to do, it will likely be different than what we have seen before.
Donald Trump turned politics inside out. The press proved itself wrong. All the pollsters are wrong. The reason for that is the fact that many Americans feel isolated, neglected, ignored, passed over, left behind, and that the division in America is between these people and the so-called elite. And it's interesting because the elite are the big business people, the Goldman Sachs, the people that run the corporations, the think tanks, etc. And the person who carried the flag for the people left behind is himself a billionaire elitist. I mean, this is is something that is absolutely impossible for anybody with trying to describe this in terms of political science or economics or anything. It defies logic.
And if we look at the early choices for his administration, two of them are Goldman Sachs officials, one former and one current. So even though he ran as a non-elitist, he's pulling the elite in.
And the generals. These represent, if you want to break down America in terms of elite and the non-elite, which you can because whether you're liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican, there is this huge separation. And the election proved the separation when the people in charge of the media and the best thought minds, etc., all thought that Donald Trump never stood a chance. Election night, I was shocked but not surprised.
What I thought was interesting about this campaign was the elevation of the trade issue to a top level. In the past, trade has surfaced below the radar for the most part, appealing to a certain subsegment, but this time it was a top-level issue that Donald Trump raised numerous times on the campaign trail. And he's kind of followed through on some of his commitments. I'm going to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He most likely will label China as a currency manipulator early in his term, and he's nominated Wilbur Ross to be his Secretary of Commerce. The Department of Commerce is responsible for enforcing all of our fair trade laws, anti-dumping and countervailing duty laws, and he took advantage of those when he was rescuing several failed steel companies in the early 2000s. So the interesting thing is that he has appealed to a certain segment of our population that has not benefited from trade. And until we devise policies that help these individuals, the politics of trade will be increasingly difficult in the United States in the years to come.
So I've got a question then. Was this a trade policy election or a foreign policy election? Or is there a difference?
I think it's primarily a trade policy election. People are concerned, some people are concerned that we've been, I guess, ripped off in international trade, that we're getting hardly anything in return for all the great things that we do. And it's also reflective in some of Trump's comments where he kind of intimated that maybe South Korea and maybe other nations should pay more in burden sharing because we have a trade deficit with them. So sometimes he mixes foreign and defense policy and trade policy all together.
Yeah, I don't think you can actually separate out the two, the trade and the foreign policy, especially as it relates to, as Phil said, the defense policies and trade policies. But Trump's rhetoric really appealed to those people, as Congressman Manzullo had stated, that felt left out by trade. And his policies and his rhetoric towards China in particular about labeling them as a currency manipulator is no longer true. It's an argument that's an outdated argument, and it doesn't reflect trade realities. So he's using perceived foreign policy inadequacies or imbalances to actually implement trade policies that are not reflective of the actual trade situation that we have at this time.
So to get back a little bit to Korea and U.S.-Korea relations, Mr. Trump mentioned Korea quite a few times during the campaign, mostly having to do with CORUS, FTA, and also having to do with the troop presence on the peninsula. We have already mentioned these as some major things going on in 2016, but my question is, now that we're post-election, is there any indication of the seriousness of the Trump administration on tackling these two things, especially towards the beginning of his new term? And I know that a lot of Koreans are very concerned about this. Are they right to be concerned about some major changes in the U.S.-Korea alliance early in the Trump administration?
On the economic front, I don't think there is much room for concern at this point. The Trump transition has laid out a 100-day agenda. Chorus is not on that agenda. No, there's no mention of Korea. And that could be a good thing, because you may not want to be on that list. But the only caveat that I would have is early February, the annual trade statistics will come out from the Department of Commerce, and most likely it will show a record trade deficit. And so that could bring the issue of Chorus back into the forefront. So, but right now there's no activity in that regard. We think that the agreement has worked very well. It's increased number of jobs in the U.S. U.S. exports have gone up. Wages associated with those working in Korean-owned firms in the United States have gone up. And actually, Chorus has helped keep the trade deficit from growing even higher. But in the campaign, the Trump folks seemed uniquely focused on the trade deficit in merchandise goods only. So we'll have to see what will happen in early February, what the reaction of the Trump administration is.
One thing to build on what Phil said, because when Trump talked about Chorus in the campaign, he talked about it using an EPI estimate of how many jobs they said Chorus had cost the United States. We've done a lot to sort of look at this situation. And in this case, it's simply the Trump administration having bad information. But one, even if you take EPI's methodology as valid, which they use numbers in a way that they're not designed to be used, because the trade deficit with Korea has been revised over the last few years consistently in our favor, the figures they have are overly inflated to begin with by their own standard. But beyond that, because they only look at the trade deficit in terms of goods, it doesn't take into account our surplus in terms of services. It doesn't take into account that foreign direct investment by South Korea has literally doubled in total stock in the United States since Chorus came into effect, from about $20 billion to $40 billion. And so it doesn't take into account all the jobs that have been created by these investments in the surplus. And so when you start looking at that, you get a completely different perspective on the job situation in the United States. So I think in some ways for Korea, you know, in a case of Chorus, it's simply a question of the administration getting better information. There's a couple industries that have had concerns about Chorus, but one of them is the auto industry. I mean, we've seen a significant increase in Korean autos in the United States, but here's the caveat. That increase took place without any of the Chorus provisions going into effect. So that wasn't related to the FTA. That was related to market conditions within the United States itself. And so, you know, this is part of what I mean by about, you know, having good information. Once you start taking out things like this large number of autos that came in without there being a change in Chorus, that, you know, suddenly that whole EPI method starts looking much different.
Can I push back just a little bit? I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, but several Trump surrogates, both before and after the election, have pointed out that we're in a post-factual world. So if we have all the good information in the world about Chorus, does it necessarily matter when the perception is, or the feeling is, that trade is bad?
I guess what I would say is that, you know, that may be fine for a campaign, it may be fine for, you know, public perception, but the challenge for a Trump administration becomes, at the end of the day, you know, as a businessman, he knows it's a good deal that matters, and if we have a good deal that's working, you don't go in and change that. And ultimately, that's based on bottom line facts. And as a businessman, he knows there's different line items and they mean different things. And so in this case, I think it's a question of, just like with any businessman, showing him, here are the ones that matter. Here is why this data you're receiving isn't correct, because And the last thing he's going to want to do is take and, you know, having come out, especially having promised jobs to the United States, start making decisions off bad information and then unwinding things that are actually working.
So this brings up a good point, Troy, about Trump being a businessman, about having a very different perspective than a lot of the presidents that we've seen in the past, or politicians in general that we've seen in the past. And in some cases, this is bringing up a little bit of uncertainty. This word keeps coming up in a lot of the news that I've been reading, uncertainty about what he will do, what he will end up being in terms of a president. And at the same time, we have South Korea going through a period of political uncertainty, the impeachment of Park Geun-hye, and the ongoing wait for the Constitutional Court decision on whether or not that impeachment will stand. So we have both sides of the alliance right now having a little bit of uncertainty. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, what are some of the things that we need to be keeping an eye on in terms of the alliance? And I'm wondering in particular, what does this uncertainty mean, given that over the course of 2016, North Korea has been quite provocative and has promised to continue to be so in 2017? What do we need to be keeping an eye out to ensure the strength of the alliance going forward?
Fortunately, there's a lot of mid and lower level officials that work together on a daily basis in the U.S. ROK alliance. You know, captains, majors, colonels, all working together all the time. So there's continuity there among the rank and file members of both governments that try to make the alliance a success.
You asked, what should we be looking for? You know, in essence, there are two technical aspects to this, one on the U.S. side and one on the South Korean side. You know, on the U.S. side, part of this is going to be, you know, the selection of officials who are going to fill in the upper levels of the Department of State and DOD, who will be managing this relationship and then helping to outline what a new Trump policy would be. So, you know, we need to look at sort of who ends up in these key positions, what type of policy the Trump administration is setting on. You know, on the South Korean side, it's a little bit different. On the one hand, you know, because we've now had impeachment of Park Geun-hye, the Constitutional Court is going to take and review the impeachment and will ultimately decide whether she remains in office or whether she leaves office. If she does leave office, we'll then have a 60-day election for the next South Korean president. You know, depending on how long it takes the court to review this, you could end up, you know, with sort of a caretaker government, if you will, under Prime Minister Wong in South Korea up until sometime in July. And so on the one hand, in South Korea, we need to sort of follow this process in terms of, you know, whether Park Geun-hye stays or how, you know, a new president comes to office. In the United States side, it's about policy development. And at the same time, you know, one of the questions you had asked earlier was, should Korea be concerned early? One never wants to go through a political crisis in any country. But that being said, right now, I think even if the Trump administration wanted to renegotiate something, it would be very difficult for South Korea to go through that. So in some ways, I think, you know, until there's more clarity on the South Korean side, if the Trump administration does want to significantly shift policies, it's going to take a while to really start doing some of this.
Can I just mix things up here?
Sure.
You both had sort of talked about this, hinted at it a bit in terms of the alliance moving forward, and one of the key possible fault lines is the deployment of THAAD. And if the next president was to come into power in Korea and was to reverse the policy that we have set up with South Korea under the Park Geun-hye government, how difficult do you think that would be, and what impact would that have on the alliance?
In terms of impact, I think part of it depends on what the context is, meaning, you know, one, you know, there's an assumption built into that, because if Park Geun-hye, if this Constitutional Court votes down the impeachment motion and she stays in power, you know, THAAD moves forward, I don't think there's any, you know, change. So, you know, the question is kind of built off an assumption that she ends up leaving office and that the opposition comes to power. Then I think it's a question of sort of, you know, is this a situation to where, you know, the opposition in Korea has had concerns about the deployment of THAAD and they reverse it maybe more in a technical sense of, we think there's a different, better way to do missile defense and so we want to do that instead? Or is it done as part of a broader, we want to reshape the U.S.-Korea alliance as well? which I think are totally different situations.
Remember, too, the U.S. never insisted or demanded that South Korea deploy THAAD. We always made it available to the Republic of Korea if they wanted to deploy that system. So this is not a bilateral issue between us and Korea's decision about whether they want to have a system or not.
This transitions really well into my final question, which is, of course, North Korea. We started off, I believe Kyle mentioned that there's an unprecedented number of nuclear and missile tests from North Korea. My question is, number one, what does that mean, the fact that they're really ramping up these types of tests? And what will it mean for 2017? Will we see another increase in their provocations and their number of tests? Will we see even further provocations? What does this 2016 North Korean aggression mean in the long run?
Well, I'll throw it out there. I think North Korea has had a history of testing new presidents. I mean, last time in 2009, there was a nuclear test and a missile test within the first half of the year. So it wouldn't surprise me if North Korea takes advantage of this opportunity, in which there is also maybe a political vacuum in South Korea in the early part of next year, and try some provocative act. It may be something that's not obvious, maybe another, you know, like cyber attack, or there'll probably be something in which he wants to test to see how far Donald Trump would go in responding to the threat.
That's possible, but the opposite's possible too. It may be that because the South Korea is in some political turmoil, why would North Korea do something provocative to galvanize South Korean public opinion again? Why not let them flounder with their domestic politics? And same with Donald Trump. The North Korean calculation might be that if North Korea is not high in his list of priorities, why make it high in his list of priorities? Why not lay low for a while?
Well, I'm sort of in the, I guess, contrarian camp on this as well. I mean, from my perspective, there are three reasons, essentially, why potentially why North Korea might refrain from things. I think, Phil, you're right that, you know, something less obvious like a cyber attack might still be possible. But one, they've had a series of tests which should have given them a lot of data. I think, you know, they tend to drive their tests by technical need rather than, you know, dates on a calendar. They might like to coordinate one if that's feasible, but ultimately I think it's the technical need. So they may not need to test anything for a while. Two, you know, I agree with Mark. I think given what's going on in South Korea, the last thing, you know, if you're Pyongyang, that you probably want to do is do something that might shift what might be a favorable political environment for you in the future, potentially. And if you do anything too overt, then you run the risk of perhaps, you know, giving the conservatives more life and maybe ending up with a new conservative president, especially if you have a split on the liberal camp side in terms of running multiple presidential candidates. Three, given that Trump is a wild card, you know, I might want to let somebody else test him to see if he's really serious or not, rather than be the ones to test him. And four, ultimately, at the end of the day, China is who you depend on as your lifeline. And if South Korea is in political turmoil, if Trump is also potentially causing problems with China by taking a call from the president of Taiwan, maybe taking and deciding that Taiwan is a chip that he can play or trade, that might open up more avenues for you to get more cooperation from China on your end. So in some ways, in the absence of them feeling a need to test, and, you know, maybe if they felt they finally had the reentry part figured out, then maybe they test for that. Mm-hmm. But I think other than that, the political circumstances actually align for them to not do anything, at least for the near term.
Yeah, and that lets us circle back to the burden-sharing question you raised, Jen, at the top. It may be the burden-sharing conversation we'll have next year will be a terrific opportunity. It'd be happening anyway because the SMA expires on a timetable. So we have to renegotiate burden sharing in 2017. And rather than being a zero-sum negotiation, you could see the burden sharing discussion as being a joint risk assessment. We in the South Korea sit down together and try to decide what we need to spend money on to defend Republic against North Korea.
It's difficult also to say with any degree of certainty when and if North Korea will test, but what we really need to watch out for is the long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, the Taepodong-2 and the KN-08, that many experts believe in the next 2, 3, 4 years that North Korea may be capable of having and attaching a payload to. which may be capable of reaching the continental United States, and how that impacts the U.S. strategic outlook towards the Korean Peninsula.
I think what's important is that Korea is in a political emergency, but not a national emergency. There's a huge distinction here. The stability of Korea is not at stake because the president has been impeached. So that political crisis, as I said, is not a national crisis, and that's important for us to realize. That's how strong the Republic of Korea is, because you know business goes on as usual. People are at the latte supermarkets buying everything they can. Exchanges continue between the two countries. Everything from the outside will look as though it's normal between the two countries, between the U.S. and Korea. And in a sense, it is, even with a new president coming in to the U.S. and the president of Korea being impeached.
So I want to wrap it up here and kind of go back to our lightning round. Obviously, 2016 was unpredictable in a lot of ways. Is there anything in 2017 that you think we really need to be looking out for, especially things that we may not know? I know it's kind of an oxymoron because you're trying to predict something that's unpredictable, but is there anything that you think we really need to be keeping an eye on, particularly with the U.S.-Korea relationship?
I think the one of the known unknowns for next year is the passage of RCEP, which is a major free trade agreement in East Asia, which does not encompass the United States, but does include Korea. And as Korea was interested in joining TPP, RCEP now poses a more tangible agreement to move forward with regional economic integration in the region. And it'd be interesting to see how that dynamic impacts the U.S.-Korea relationship is in terms of cooperation on regional economic engagement.
I think for the alliance itself, one of the things that we need to watch for is how the sanctions are impacting the North Korean economy. And there's a couple reasons I'll give that, which is that one, you know, there's a lot of questions about whether this process of sanctions can be successful. I think we need to continue sort of like we did with 2270, where we saw that there were these loopholes. And if we see, you know, things like that being exploited again, we then need to work with our partners in China and Russia and others to try and close those loopholes so that way the sanctions can be effective. But sort of the more, what you're getting at, sort of unsurprising thing is Steph Haggard has talked some about this before, you know, that he would expect that when the sanctions really bite, you'll see a currency crisis in North Korea. And so I think we need to be watching for, if this isn't simply a question of the sanctions biting in terms of the economy slowing down and putting pressure on North Korea, but if they go into a real type of crisis, you know, what happens internally, and then what steps we as alliance partners need to make in terms of managing that crisis?
I guess my big question for next year is, the Obama administration had some success in confronting Russia in some policy areas and cooperating with Russia in others, such as nonproliferation. So will the Trump administration be able to confront China on economic issues, but cooperate with them on North Korea? Well, that's more of a question for China than it is for us.
Well, the issue of North Korea has always been determined by China. North Korea's biggest trading partner, call it what you want, but most of all, they get most of their energy from China. I mean, China could just turn off the spigot if it wanted to.
All right, any closing thoughts? I think we've touched on a lot of interesting and important things in this discussion. Is there anything else that people did not get a chance to say?
Yeah, what about South Korean popular culture next year?
Come on, Jenna. I'm very much interested.
All I will say is that it's going strong, despite some reports of problems with getting visas to go into China. And I think there have been some sporadic reports, but I'm still skeptical about how widespread that is. And I think that it would be really hard to crack down on the insane popularity of Korean pop culture in China, even if they took a sustained effort to do so. And I will point out, too, that South Korea had a record number of tourists enter their country this year. They already broke the record before the November and December numbers were even announced. And that 50% of the people who entered South Korea this year were coming from China. So there's a lot stronger interest and a lot stronger ties there than I think people realize. And it won't be dismissed so easily. So I'm not too worried about Hallyu in the coming year. I think people have been predicting the death of Hallyu for 10 years now, and it's still going strong. So
didn't they just have their biggest soap opera in terms of overseas sales? What was it? Descendants of the Sun?
Descendants of the Sun, yep, was even bigger than My Love from the Star, if you can believe that, for those of you who have watched these lovely Korean soap operas.
Will there be a season two?
That's a good question. They talked about it, but no plans yet, so stay tuned, guys. All right, I really want to thank you all for taking your time and sharing all your expertise. We have some great experts here at KDI in-house, and so I always love to draw on you guys, so I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Jenna.
Well, that's all for the very first episode of Korean Context for 2017. I hope you guys enjoyed our discussion and are looking forward to some really great episodes throughout this year. I have already recorded a ton of interviews that are ready to go, so we should have some great stuff for you. As always, please remember to subscribe and like our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, and tune in again next week for another episode.